Well, thanks, Gary, and good morning, everyone. I hope you're having a great conference. I know I am. This is for sure my favorite week of the year. You get to see old friends, make new friends, and judging by all the business I see out in the aisle, there's a lot of business being done. And that's a great thing to say in biodiesel right now. Business is being done. We have a great panel discussion for you this morning. We're going to talk about some of the most important state and local policies from across the country. And to help us do that, we have a number of the people who are most influential in passing and implementing those policies. But before we get into that discussion, I want to take just a second to set the stage. I think most of you, if not all of you, are familiar with our federal policy initiatives, the RFS2, the tax credit, the CCC program. For sure, important programs, really the cornerstone of the industry. But state programs, and you're probably a little less familiar with those, they're also important. We have also a very rich a network of state policies, just like at the federal level, and they serve as a great insurance policy against those federal programs. But longer term, I really think that state programs offer us even more than just a hedge or a safety net. I think there are growth opportunities there, especially with low carbon fuel standards. But we'll get into some of the longer term opportunities in our panel discussion. But let's take a second to talk about what we have right now. Right now, eight states have passed statewide mandates. Four of those have been implemented. And now with about one state a year passing a mandate since 2002, now even municipalities are getting into the action. New York City just last year passed the nation's first municipal biodiesel bioheat mandate. So in 2012, every gallon of the more than 1 billion gallons of heating oil consumed in the city of New York will be blended with biodiesel. It really is just a great story for the industry. And what a precedent that the greatest city on earth is using biodiesel in every gallon of fuel that's used to heat the very famous buildings and structures there. But we also, of course, have climate change. Climate change has become a popular top-tier issue in the past few years. And as is so many times the case, with popular issues with voters, states aren't waiting for the federal government to act. Oregon has passed a low-carbon fuel standard for transportation fuels. California's passed and now implemented the nation's first low-carbon fuel standard. And not to be left behind by their counterparts on the left coast, our friends on the East Coast, 11 governors from Northeast states have signed a compact agreeing to implement a low-carbon fuel standard of their own. And so if you look at those states, that's well over a third of the U.S. diesel market is looking at a low-carbon fuel standard. And then finally, we have good old-fashioned incentives. Even though states over the past couple of years have gone through very difficult fiscal times, some would say historically difficult fiscal times, still more than half of states have financial incentives for the use or production of biodiesel. And these can be significant. They range anywhere from just a few cents per gallon of B100 to more than a dollar per gallon of B100. So again, a very rich set of policies, just like our federal programs. But of the policies I mentioned, they're all structured differently. Mandates, LCFS, incentives, they work differently. But they have one thing in common. They make an impact. They impact the sales of use of biodiesel in a state or a region, even nationally in some instances. And as we heard yesterday, they're impacting where RFS blending is occurring. And then finally, and most importantly, they impact the profitability of producers, sometimes profoundly, as we'll hear from some of our panelists. So with that introduction, I'd like to bring out our panelists, and I hope you'll help me welcome them as I introduce them. First, from the state of Pennsylvania, the CEO of Keystone Biofuels, Mr. Ben Wooten. Welcome. From Illinois, senior consultant with Mark IV and the NBB, Rebecca Richardson. From Minnesota, past NBB chair, Mr. Ed Hegland. And from the great state of California, from REG, Mr. Eric Bowen. Last but not least, from the state of New York, NBB Governing Board Member and Senior Executive with Sprague Energy Corporation, Mr. Stephen Levy. Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Good morning.
Thank you for being here. Appreciate the time you've taken to share your experiences and your expertise. It really is a privilege to be able to sit down with all of you who've been so influential in your states in one room, albeit a very large room, to discuss some of these issues. So, Stephen, let's jump in with you. I want to talk a little bit about New York. It's said if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere. And I hope that's true because we have had a heck of a run in the five boroughs the last couple of years. What do you think accounts for the popularity of biodiesel in that area of the country?
Well, Shelby, you know, if you were writing for the Harvard Business Journal, you would have a chapter, balanced scorecard number 2, or strategic partners get together, or strange bedfellows unite. And essentially, that's what really happened in New York. You know, it's not often that you have legislators, industry, and environmentalists come together that all have the same cause. In New York, yes, as Keith has gotten the award this morning, they've been using biodiesel for some time, and it was a natural transition to move to biodiesel. You had a city councilman, chair of the environmental committee, the mayor of New York, both wanting to do the right things for the city to reduce emissions, and most importantly, where New York wants to be the lowest carbon city in the United States. We have the environmentalists, where we have the headquarters here in New York, that want to reduce emissions. Community boards wants to be more green and reduce emissions. But even more importantly, we have industry. People that compete on the street that understand and realize that they need more of a green product. Everyone came together, which helped initiate the legislation. And, you know, we talk about the watchwords every day of biodiesel and bioheat, reducing our carbon footprints, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, energy dependence, increasing jobs, being more sustainable. And the reality of it is that's really happened. But even more important for our industry, you mentioned the 1 billion gallons of heating oil in New York. But that will also give the entree and the stepping stone to help turn over 7 billion gallons of heating fuel throughout the United States. And even though New York is mandated for a B2, in 2012, there's already discussion to bring it up to a B5. And the other key result of this is that not only will it bring infrastructure to New York just for bioheat, but it will also bring that infrastructure to push bioheat use throughout the region, as well as new biodiesel applications.
Yeah, what a great story that is. It's with all of the sustainability issues that we've been working on the past couple of years, where many of the major environmental groups and others are headquartered in New York City, the vote on the bioheat mandate was 48-0. I mean, what a story that really is. And so maybe we've turned the corner on some of these issues.
Well, I think we have, and you know, it's a trend not just in New York, but as we all know in the United States and the world, to become more sustainable and not only use crops, agricultural, that are grown not only throughout the United States, but you'll start to see more crops grown in New York, and most importantly, to use our waste streams. And as you know, we have many restaurants in New York, so use cooking oil and so on. Will be there to produce and make bioheat and biodiesel. Even as much that, you know, all of this doesn't take place overnight when someone has an idea. You know, you need heroes. There's a lot of heroes in this room. There are many stakeholders that help get the bioheat mandate passed in New York. But even more importantly, we all have a vested interest. And it all would not have been done either without the help of NBB staff like yourself, and all the outreach and education that MBB serves.
Well, thank you, Stephen. You're right. There were a lot of champions and heroes in New York City, but appreciate your humility. But certainly, you were one of those, and appreciate your efforts there. Eric, let's move to you. You can't talk about state policy without talking about California. Sometimes, unfortunately, if I'm being completely honest, but California is the second largest diesel market in the country by a wide margin, the most active from a regulatory perspective, by a wide margin, the most influential. And now California's become the first state in the country to do a low-carbon fuel standard. How do you see that working out for biodiesel?
Well, appreciate the question, Shelby. Somewhat of a complicated answer. Let's start back with Governor Schwarzenegger, who we have to thank for initially getting the low-carbon fuel standard started, actually all the way back in 2007 by his executive order. So we are now just beginning, as you know, in January 1 of this year to implement, but there's been years and years of effort going in to get to this point. In order to really understand the opportunity that the low-carbon fuel standard presents for biodiesel, you really have to understand two things, I think, to begin with. First, what is the goal of the policy? And then secondly, what mechanism did California choose to accomplish that goal? The goal itself is fairly straightforward. It's a 10% of carbon reduction for all transportation fuels in California by the year 2020. And so that's phased in between now and 2020 with an increasing ramp. The mechanism that was chosen is quite, at the time, unique and quite distinct than, say, the federal program RFS2, where the renewable fuel standard sets goals for specific fuels. The market mechanism approach was chosen for the low-carbon fuel standard. So what they've chosen to do is they've taken all fuels, starting with the incumbent fuels of diesel and gasoline, and given them a carbon intensity score, or a CI score, and then all potential alternative fuels. So this, of course, includes biodiesel, but also would include renewable diesel, corn ethanol, sugarcane ethanol, cellulosic ethanol, natural gas, electricity. And so each of those fuels now has its own carbon score. And the idea is that the power of the marketplace will produce the most efficient and cost-effective carbon reduction as people choose the right fuels to reach the mandated reduction levels. So, as you said, California, one of the largest fuel markets in the entire world, this is a multi-billion gallon opportunity for lower carbon fuel, so huge opportunity. But unlike RFS2, where it is a specific diesel mandate, again, biodiesel will have to compete in a marketplace of lower carbon fuels, and so there is no guaranteed success. Though biodiesel has scored very, very favorably, and in the cases of biodiesel made from waste products like used cooking oil or edible corn oil, are actually the lowest fuels that have scored with their carbon intensity. So enormous opportunity, you know, 80-type percent carbon reduction compared to petroleum diesel. So the opportunity is huge, but success is not guaranteed. I think there are three key things that will need to be addressed and that the industry itself needs to engage on in order to maximize the opportunity for biodiesel. The first of those would be infrastructure. Right now, the alcohol-based fuels enjoy a huge advantage over biodiesel in that they have infrastructure tie-ins. There's ethanol blended at all California racks because ethanol is a oxygenate that we use when we phased out MTBE. There is no rack-blended biodiesel available in California today. So in order to cost-effectively get biodiesel into the marketplace, particularly at the lower blends, we're going to have to work with the state of California to secure grant funds. We're going to have to work with the petroleum industry and the infrastructure providers like Kinder Morgan to really get the infrastructure in place to allow biodiesel to effectively enter the marketplace. So that's the first thing we need to do. The second thing we need to do is, as many in this room may be aware, we had an issue in California with underground storage tanks and the storage of biodiesel. California Biodiesel Alliance and National Biodiesel Board have worked successfully to create a 3-year grace period to allow biodiesel to continue to flow in California. We're going to need to find a longer-term solution, continue to engage on that process, work with federal EPA, work with the tank manufacturers, and get that done. done. I think we'll do it, but we got to sustain our efforts. The third issue is, as people like to joke, it's the nation state of California. So we don't think that it's appropriate for us to adopt national definitions of fuels, and we have our own definition of gasoline and our own definition of diesel, and we're right now working on our own definition of biodiesel. So it's very important that as we do that, that we get that definition right. And this is another great example where the National Biodiesel Board, working with California Biodiesel Alliance and industry stakeholders, both research institutions like NREL as well as petroleum industry associations, are really working with the regulators to put in place the right definitions for biodiesel and the right emission profile data to get a situation where biodiesel can effectively work in the California marketplace. So if we can work together as an industry and continue to sustain our efforts in Sacramento and accomplish those three goals, I really believe that biodiesel has a billion-plus gallon opportunity to help California achieve its low-carbon reduction goals.
So it's pretty much done.
I should have it done by Friday.
Well, great. Well, that's certainly good for my frequent flyer account, but that's a very good synopsis of what's going on in California. I totally agree. A ton of potential in California, but still a lot of work to done. I want to thank you and the CBA for the work you've done. I know I saw Kent Bullard out there. He's done some great work, especially on the UST work. We don't have a lot of stakeholders in California, but we have good stakeholders in California. Thank you for heading up those efforts. Next, I want to move to Ed. Ed, you've been at this for a while in Minnesota. I want to talk about the Minnesota mandate. In my opinion, the Minnesota mandate has been the single most influential state policy that's ever been passed. I don't think that we would see the other mandates if it wasn't for Minnesota and the experience that you all have had and the way that you've addressed things. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience, than a decade-long experience now?
Certainly, Shelby. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak here. One of the things we try and do at the Biodiesel Conference is reuse and recycle, and I think Shelby asking me being up here, he's accomplished both with this, so thank you.
This is the last time you ever have to do the general session.
That's what I heard last year. In Minnesota, as I'm sure most of you know, we do have a 5% biodiesel mandate at this time. We started at 2%. When we were working towards that and lobbying in St. Paul, we started in 99, 2000, 2001. It finally passed in 2002. We used the talking points, biodiesel talking points, looking at energy, the environment, the economic benefits of biodiesel. The other thing we talked about quite often was jump-starting the biodiesel industry, because in 2000, 2001, there really wasn't a very viable biodiesel industry. When we were talking to our state representatives, our state senators, it was a little bit easier maybe in the fact that we had an existing successful ethanol mandate and a very successful ethanol industry, and so at least they knew what renewable fuels were all about. And as I said, it was passed in 2005, or it was passed in 2002, it was enacted in 2005. That first year we did have some problems, and I don't want to dwell on negatives here, but I think the outcome was very positive. There were some cold flow issues that first winter, and we were able to get together with the key stakeholders in Minnesota, the biodiesel plants, the farm groups, and Minnesota Department of Commerce, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and basically voluntarily decided to put a waiver in place until we figured out what was going on. I think the result of all that was really a better cold flow spec for the entire industry. And then going further, we did have some other issues that a couple other issues that came up that we were able to get this same group of people together and proactively work on and really solve these problems for the betterment of the entire industry. In around 2006 and 2007, Governor Pawlenty started an initiative to get us up to B20 or to a B20 blend by 2015. It was not something we started as a biodiesel council or as a soybean group in Minnesota, but it was certainly something we monitored and worked very closely to steer it to be as workable as possible for the biodiesel industry. So right now we're at 5%. That ramps up to 10% in 2012, and ultimately is proposed to be at 20% in 2015. One of the things, as I look at the roadmap that we started, when we started dreaming about a biodiesel mandate and looking for a biodiesel industry. In 2002, when it passed, we had zero production capacity in Minnesota. By the time it was enacted in 2005, we had 63 million gallons of production capacity. And so we truly did, at least in Minnesota, jumpstart an industry. Another thing, in 2010, with the lack of the biodiesel tax credit, I'd heard from some producers in the Midwest that the Minnesota mandate truly did provide some market certainty and some market demand for those plants and for biodiesel. So I think as we look, as I tell this little story and we look at the challenges and successes, I think it's given other states some things to build on. I think some other state legislatures have modeled their legislation after some of the things we've done. So the even though the leading edge is often the bleeding edge, we survived and we have a vibrant biodiesel industry and a mandate at 5% currently.
Yeah, absolutely, Ed. And as you said, the Minnesota policy has been hugely successful from the standpoint of demand and consistent demand. I talked to Ralph Groshen from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture a couple of weeks ago, and the percentage of capacity that's used in Minnesota is nearly four times the national average. And it's obviously because of the mandate. Right. But to me, that's not the real story. The real story is the issues that you all have dealt with and the way you've done that, because it's allowed states like Pennsylvania and Oregon to have completely seamless implementations of biodiesel mandates. So again, thank you all for your great work. Rebecca, I want to move to you next. You were with the Illinois Soybean Association when the Illinois tax incentive was passed, and what a great policy that has been. Can you tell us how that works?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. First of all, I want to say that I'm really honored to be a part of this panel up here. There have been tremendous efforts accomplished, and it's an honor to be among you gentlemen. So I'd be happy to tell the story about Illinois, which I feel very passionately about. The tax incentive in Illinois is a two-structured or two-tiered incentive. And for biodiesel blends of 10% or below, the tax incentive is a 20% discount on sales tax for diesel fuel sold in Illinois. But for blends above 10%, so starting at B11, there's a total sales tax forgiveness on the full gallon of diesel fuel that is sold in Illinois. So that really has spearheaded a lot of interest in industry growth in the state. And it's worked really well, and just as we had hoped and envisioned and dreamed that it would work, it's brought green jobs to Illinois at a time when most industries have laid people off, and even in the biodiesel industry, you know, there have been really rough times in other states. In our state, we've grown the industry and grown it in a very reasonable, sustainable, practical way. It's made diesel fuel more cost competitive with the neighbors to our east and west, so we don't have truckers driving through our state and buying gas on, or buying diesel fuel on both sides. We now actually have increased diesel sales in Illinois, which brings greater greater revenue for with road tax back to the state. So, you know, that's part of the story that we can tell is that for the investment that we've made, we've brought jobs to the state. We have we've created some additional revenue for the state through the state excise tax program, and it's really been a good story. And much of we anticipate that much of the obligation for RFS2 will be focused in Illinois because we've built the business and we have a very robust business interest in trying to grow the industry in that part of the country.
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing is it really shows the value of biodiesel as you know, we think of biodiesel as green and dependence on foreign oil and sustainability. But one of the things that we forget a lot of times is that biodiesel, just like any industry, is economic development. It really is an economic development activity, and so the Illinois tax incentive is pretty significant. But it drives more than 100 million gallons of consumption. It's had effects like RFS blending. A lot of RFS blending is going to happen in Illinois as a result of that. And so the net to the taxpayers is a win.
Absolutely.
Which is something that sometimes we forget to tell that side of the story. Well, Ben, let's go to you next. There are probably 800 or 900 people in the audience, but don't worry about that. but I think of all these people, you've got the best deal of anybody. in Pennsylvania with the policy framework that you and some of the other stakeholders put together. Can you tell us what you have there?
Absolutely. And first, let me say that I believe the most important component to reaching a sustainable biodiesel market is good public policy. And as Shelby mentioned, in Pennsylvania, we do have a state mandate. We do have a state incentive. And our story starts back in 2007 when we were trying to define what the policy landscape should look like for Pennsylvania. And what we determined was we knew we needed money, but we also determined that relying on a government subsidy for a long period of time didn't make a good business plan. So we knew we needed a market requirement as well. And so what we did is we actually pushed two bills through the legislature, one for an incentive, and we were asking for $1 per gallon for 5 years. We settled for a three-year program at 75 cents per gallon. We would have taken 50, but we were happy to get the 75. The three-year was critical.
You compromised at 75 cents a gallon.
75 cents. The three-year was a line in the sand for us. We needed enough time to work with the stakeholders involved to make sure that when we rolled out the mandate, we did it as best as we could. And it took about 18 months, and we worked with all the stakeholders, the petroleum industry, the logistics side, the state agencies. NBB helped in setting up processes for us. And the result was, in May of 2010, a B2 rolled out. And our mandate set up where it's a B2 on road. So for every gallon of petroleum diesel that's sold in Pennsylvania, it has contained 2% biodiesel. We have legislation proposed right now to include off-road and home heat, and we hope to get that wrapped up by summertime. But by implementing that mandate, it obviously was great for the industry. It was a tenfold increase in market. We went from about consuming 4 million gallons a year to 40 million gallons a year. And that generated a lot of producers in the state reinvesting in their plants, more capacity, better efficiencies. But it also had a trickle effect where outside industry was coming in. Crushing industries and rendering industries were either expanding their current operations, or there's several proposed to start up this year to take advantage of this mandate. So it's a good example of how good public policy, working with some public dollars, and by the way, Pennsylvania spent $5 million in 2010, and just the biodiesel side alone generated over $200 million of economy. Mm. So it's a good example of how a little bit of public dollars leveraged with private dollars, it's a win-win for everybody, and we're very, very happy and pleased with what we got going on there.
Well, you should be. You have a mandate and a huge production incentive. but the thing I love about your story, Ben, is you weren't completely happy with your business climate in Pennsylvania, and so you just changed it. I mean, that's the great thing about state government policy is state governments are in your backyard, and it's completely within the power of stakeholders to improve your business climate through your state legislature, through some of the policies that we've talked about. Every single one of these things was done because of stakeholders, and everybody can do this. But Ben, I know that you did. You probably went a little further than most in starting an organization and some things like that. Can you tell us how you did that?
We did. And first of all, this is going to sound like a politician, but yes, you can. I mean, if Pennsylvania can do it, any state can do it. And you hear Joe and Manning and Larry and Ed and people get up here and talk about reaching out to your politician, you know, advocating on biodiesel, that one voice can make a difference. And Pennsylvania's a prime example of that. And what we did is all the producers in the state came together, and we formed the Pennsylvania Biodiesel Producers Group. We took the idea from the guys down in Texas doing what they were doing. And everybody, every producer was critical in getting this policy passed. So I encourage anybody that's in this industry or thinking about getting in this industry that you need to make advocating biodiesel public policy part of your routine business day to day. It definitely is going to pay dividends.
Yeah, great points, Ben. And I think one of the things that you mentioned that I want to just highlight real quickly is that you said that everybody came together and everybody pushed in the same direction. One of the other commonalities between states that have really good policy is the stakeholders have come together with a unified vision. They more or less get along, mm-hmm. and they have a united front, and they lobby together.
It was critical.
If you're not together, you're sunk. And I think that really all of the states represented here have done a great job mm-hmm. on that front. Well, we have a few minutes left in our panel, and I want to come back to Eric and Stephen. Really, the million-dollar question at this point, and probably the question I get the most, is what's going to happen in California with the low-carbon fuel standard? And what's going to happen in the Northeast? Every state except New Hampshire has either passed or implemented a bioheat mandate. And then, of course, the 11 governors have pledged to do a low-carbon fuel standard. So it's unknowable for me. But I know that you two have a great idea what's going to go on. So I want you to look deep into your crystal balls and tell us exactly how this is going to work out and what the biodiesel market's going to look like in maybe 2 years and then maybe longer term, 5 or 10. Eric, you want to start us off?
Sure.
Now be specific, too.
Crystal ball. Let's see. we'll all go bold. I will say California will exceed the 5x15 goal. We will lead the nation again in biodiesel adoption. It will happen because biodiesel will be the lowest cost low-carbon solution for the obligated parties in California. And so we will grow our own California domestic production, and we will be a large importer of biodiesel from other states to help us achieve those low-carbon goals. I think that will happen in the following way. I think we will, over the next 4 years between now and 2015, have rack blended biodiesel at the vast majority of California racks. I think that a bunch of that will be subsidized through California Energy Commission AB 118 grant funds. I think that we will work with the petroleum industry and WISPA in particular to get a positive outcome for the biodiesel emission regulations that really make B5 a seamless fuel in California the same way it has been done under the ASTMD 975 rules. And I think that everyone will once again be very proud of the leadership that California has been able to provide the nation in figuring out how we can continue to have transportation fuels that are clean, domestically produced, and generate good paying jobs here in America.
There you go. Well, I agree with you, Eric, and I think that maybe the biggest sign of that is that we've been getting a lot of help from the petroleum industry and the government affairs realm. I think that they really want to use our product to help meet those LCFS goals, and we welcome their assistance for sure. Well, Stephen, you only have 11 states to look after, so this will be a much simpler task for you. So what exactly do you think is going to happen in the Northeast?
Well, believe it or not, Shelby, our tasks are directly related to the work that's being done in California. So if we can have a simple, direct definition of biodiesel and the low-carbon fuel standard, it makes our work a lot easier so we can get things done a lot quicker. Because as we all know, when it comes to the environment and emissions, that the Northeast follows California quite frequently. So hopefully you'll make our job a lot easier.
I'll do my best.
But even more importantly, you know, some predictions. We will see New York City go to at least the B5 by 2015 for bioheat. There will be a low-carbon fuel standard in the Northeast by the 11 states within the next 2 to 3 years, which will mean transportation fuels will have some type of bio content, including biodiesel. In the low-carbon fuel standard, as a memorandum of understanding by all the states in the Northeast, each state will also have a specific sustainability or climate policy that's regulated to their particular region or locality, which could mean using agricultural products in their areas or in Massachusetts, using more waste as is in New York and New Jersey, and up in Maine and New Hampshire perhaps have a primary waste stream of, you know, woody chips. But one thing is clear, they will all agree on using biodiesel, and hopefully they will all consider bioheat. And probably the biggest bold prediction I can give is that by 2025, 2030, we will start to see in the heating oil industry higher efficient boilers come into the Northeast, which will be able to use blends of B20, B50, and at some point, B100. But in any case, as sure as
we're... Wow, B100.
And B100. We'll still be around, Shelby. Well, I will be. I don't know. But it's coming, and you know, and it's happening not just in the Northeast, but everyone who's sitting here, whether you know you live in the Midwest or in California or in Seattle or Texas, you will be touched by some type of low-carbon fuel program, a sustainability program, that either will be mandated to you, or there will be some type of grassroots initiative that will affect what you do every day.
Well, that's a great note to end our panel on. And once again, I want to thank you all for being here. Members of the audience, thank you for your attention. Thank you for coming to the conference. And God bless.
Thank you.
Thank you.